All right. Thank you for attending session 262, titled Typical Sexual Shame Residue from Religious Upbringings. Please silence your cell phones. We ask that all here today engage thoughtfully and respectfully, understanding that we all come from varying backgrounds and beliefs. Please be respectful in your comments and questions. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Am I using my, like, infomercial voice? I feel very infomercial-ish. Okay. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within their framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. Okay, about this session. Is it working? I'm starting to get nervous because I'm more than halfway done and the presentation isn't up yet. Okay. Although Mormonism has quite a bit of sexual positivity in its doctrine, the cultural processes in wards, stakes, and family systems teach mostly fear, shame, and the thou shalt nots. This leaves many members of our church with problems like unrealistic expectations, inadequate education, unnecessary self or partner shaming, rigid belief systems, and underdeveloped processes when it comes to our relationship with sexuality. This session will offer some reframings that can help attendees embrace their sexuality in healthier ways. Kristen Marie Bennion, LCSW and CST, is a licensed mental health therapist and a certified sex therapist. She owns her own practice in Orem, Utah, where she primarily treats sex and intimacy concerns, and she's currently working toward her PhD in human sexuality. Natasha Helfer-Parker, LCMFT, CST, has been in practice as a mental health professional for over 20 years, primarily working with issues of relational health, faith transitions and journeys, and sexuality. She writes a blog called The Mormon Therapist and hosts the podcasts Mormon Mental Health and Mormon Sex Info. And now we will turn over the time to the presenters. Maybe? Yes? All right. So hopefully we'll get this, because we have a video we want to share. So that's why the PowerPoint matters. Otherwise, we can do without it. But sometimes it's nice for us visual learners to be able to have something to see. So we always start our sexuality type workshops with a bit of just either expectations or disclosures about what you can expect from meeting here for an hour. We try to do this because sexuality is obviously very personal, and we all have very unique experiences around our sexual histories, our sexual developments, and possibly even trauma experiences, which we know affects about a third of us in this room and anywhere in the world. And probably those numbers actually are higher because that's of the people who are willing to say that there was some type of sexual trauma in their past. So one of the things that we really expect, especially in the comments section, is what is shared here stays here. That we, I know this is recorded and all of that, but in the sense of not necessarily going outside of circles and saying, can you believe what I heard, you know, or things of that nature. So we just want to be cognizant of each other's privacy. We are not here really to cover much on sexual trauma. So I want to be very clear about that. That's kind of its own presentation. So, but that doesn't, But that doesn't mean that things may not come up for you, something we call maybe triggers, as we talk about things. And if any of you know me personally, I tend to have a little bit of a sense of humor when I talk about sex. I tend to try to be lighthearted because I'm trying. It's actually intentional. Some of it is my personality. Some of it is because I'm nervous. And some of it is intentional. So, because I'm trying to lighten the mood a little bit when it comes to our kind of sexual histories. At the same time, I never want to be offensive or dismissive of things that could be very traumatic for people in this realm. So I just want to be clear that this is not meant to address sexual trauma, today's presentation. But if you have triggers or things come up for you, that's normal, and that we are more than happy to help you talk about that after our session today in private or email me or whatever you'd like to do as far as contacting me later. Another thing we want to be clear about is we are experts. I mean, we've done a lot of study. We've paid a lot of money. We've done a lot of things to become experts in the sex therapy field. At the same time, we are experts in the field, not in your life. So you are the expert of your life, and you're free to disagree with us. You're free to have things that are useful for you that we may think are not useful. You have, you know, a lot of autonomy, we are hoping, in your ability to decide what's right for you and your partnerships and your life, either individually or in partnership. So that suggestions are suggestions, right? They're tidbits that may or may not be helpful. We really encourage people, especially if you are in a partnership, to not use us as what I call clubs back home. In other words, well, but Natasha said, you know. And or a lot of times it's interesting how I'll share one story that maybe identifies with you, but that doesn't mean that there isn't another side to that story. And so if you just go home, like, for example, I'm known a lot for talking about how we demonize pornography use, but then it's probably not helpful to go home and say, see, you shouldn't be upset about my pornography use because Natasha said that it's really no big deal, which is not really what I said to begin with, but I am trying to normalize, you know, something that maybe we have over-exaggerated in our culture. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have a right to have a relational problem in your particular situation. So just try not to use me as a weapon back home. You can come back and tattle to me if your spouse has done that. And the other thing that we want to talk a lot about is just we really encourage, as we talk about these topics, self-awareness. So really pay attention to yourself. Pay attention to your body. Pay attention to your thoughts. Pay attention to your heart rate. Pay attention to things that might be coming up for you, because we feel like that is all very informative as far as what are some areas in your particular life that you may want to either be a little bit more curious about or ask questions about or anything of that nature. So we encourage that. We'll probably remind you about that on a regular basis today. Are we up? Yay! All right, so I can put this. Well, I'll leave this here. All right.
I can speak loudly. One of my favorite things to talk about with my clients is dissecting the various roles of discomfort that can show up in our lives. Often, I will start working with someone who's having some struggles, often within the intersection of faith and sexuality, and they will feel really uncomfortable with what we're talking about, or really uncomfortable talking about it with their spouse or something like that. And it becomes helpful to break down that, hey, when we're uncomfortable, when anxiety hits, or when get out that feeling comes, often there are a lot of reasons that might show up. Right.
And before we talk about the reasons that might show up, what's the number one reason we've been told, if you've grown up in a kind of mainstream LDS culture, what's the number one reason you think that we've been told that discomfort shows up? Either the Holy Ghost or Satan, right? Okay.
Get out. Right? So a main one, a really important one, is if we're walking down a dark alley, if we see a lion over in the corner, I really hope that my body sends a signal, get out of there, this is dangerous. So it can really serve as quite the function to keep us alive, really, and it's been around as long as we have. And then often is if we hear information that just doesn't, it's something we haven't heard before. If you all are familiar with confirmation bias, like we like to hear what we already know, something, and oh yeah, that's right, we're right. What we've been taught is right. When we hear something that kind of starts to create that cognitive dissonance, that feels uncomfortable. Like what? And so that can make us steer away from that.
So for example, if you were 12 and in a bishop's interview and a lot of information coming your way about masturbation and you felt uncomfortable, maybe you were getting some incorrect information, but I'm guessing most of you probably didn't know that that's why you were uncomfortable.
Another one that
I didn't when I was 12.
She knows now. another one that I didn't put up there is growth. You know, so we a lot of us in here when we go in to take tests or do something we haven't done before, that can feel really, really stressful. But often we do it anyway, and we see that it gets easier, and then it all of a sudden isn't so uncomfortable. So that's a big one that a lot of people experience.
A good example of that is physical therapy, which I don't know how many of you have knee surgeries like me, but when I'm driving to the torture machine and willing to pay for a lot of pain, I'm like, this is growth producing, woohoo. That's sexuality often brings up growth opportunities. New information. So I often say that the first time I heard about French kissing, I thought it was pretty disgusting. People do what with their tongues and stick them where? By 15, I had changed my mind. So
not so uncomfortable.
New information is oftentimes uncomfortable, but that doesn't mean that Satan or the Holy Ghost is involved. So,
okay. Do you want to give them?
Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Are we doing the, is this the video? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to just share with you a video that will have some of the messages that we have heard growing up. Let me, just by a show of hands, because I know there's a lot of different people here from lots of different backgrounds. How many of you grew up in the LDS mainstream church? Okay, so the majority. Okay, so hands up. How many of you did not? Okay, how many of you were converts out of that group that just said they did not? Okay, so you're still fairly familiar with LDS mainstream sexual rhetoric? Okay. Who would say they're not familiar with sexual rhetoric coming from the LDS mainstream church? Okay, so bear with us and ask a lot of questions afterwards. All right, so these are messages that we grew up hearing about, over the pulpit that we're going to be listening to now. And there's a time in the video that Kristen has done a really nice job of putting kind of into verbal affirmation, little word sentences of messages that we've all probably heard at some point and maybe self-identified with. And they tend to be sex negative. So, and that'll take like 2 or 3 minutes where just these kind of words are popping up. And instead of being bored, which you might be, I would prefer, if you take that opportunity, to really tune into what I was talking about before. So what's happening for me as I read through some of these phrases, and does anything either resonate or not resonate, and where is that showing up in my body? Okay, so we'll start that. This is about 6 minutes long.
Young women, you must stand guard of yourself, your family, and all those with whom you associate. You must be guardians of virtue.
The dress of a woman has a powerful impact upon the minds and passions of men. If it is too low or too high or too tight, it may prompt improper thoughts, even in the mind of a young man who is striving to be pure. Our dress affects not only our thoughts and actions, but also the thoughts and actions of others. Women particularly can dress modestly and in the process contribute to their own self-respect and to the moral purity of men.
Keep your dress modest. Short skirts are not pleasing to the Lord, but modesty is. In the category of crimes, only murder and denying the Holy Ghost come ahead of illicit sexual relations. Girls, do not be an enticement for your downfall because of your immodest and tight-fitting clothes.
And young women, please understand that if you dress immodestly, you are magnifying this problem by becoming pornography to some of the men who see you.
In the end, most women get the type of man they dress for.
Being a guardian of virtue means you will never text words or images to young men that may cause them to lose the spirit, their priesthood power, or lose their virtue.
That man or woman who resists temptation and lives without sin is far better off than the man or woman who has fallen, no matter how repentant the latter may be. Young sisters, be modest. Modesty in dress,
say something I'm giving up,
is a true mark of refinement and a hallmark of the virtuous Latter-day Saint woman.
I'll be the one if you want me to. Anywhere I would have followed you. Say something, I'm giving up on you. And I am feeling so small. It was over my head. I know nothing at all. Stumble and fall. I'm still learning to love, just starting to crawl. Say something, I'm giving up on you. I'm sorry.
To speak to you about personal purity.
Say something.
Solomon said that the price of a virtuous woman is far above rubies. Young women, guard and protect your virtue as you would your very life.
It's one thing to get a presentation ready. It's another thing to look at all of you looking at that. It's emotional. Okay, so I would like to open up the room just for shout-outs as far as either one, things you noticed, either feeling or physical, and two, what do you feel some of the messages are that we have received? Yeah. That sexual assault is what?
Their fault.
That the sexual assault is the victim's fault. Okay, thank you.
That we're in charge of
women are in charge of men's thoughts and behaviors.
That the atonement
has limited effect on sexual sin. That sexual purity is more important than my life. I feel really sad and teary. So feeling like you're holding your breath, reminding you of your bishop talking about masturbation and how that feeling of holding your breath in. A lot of fear, raising five girls, and that these are the messages that they would be hearing in young women's. They get reminder calls. They're going to go play volleyball, so make sure the girls are wearing appropriate shorts. Because you know what happens at volleyball meets, right? Sorry, I got snarky. Yes. So the fear of church leaders who speak in hyperbole in order to try to control children or adolescents from having sexual experiences. Their fear to us. Yes, thank you. There's so many. Yes, Diane, and then I'll go back. So anger that older white men are trying to police women. When they don't know anything about what life is like for a woman in or out of the church. And then there was,
yes.
Immodesty is shameful. Yes. You, yep. That virtue and chastity are the same thing. Would love to know from men if 2 inches of shoulder length make a difference. Yes, that would be helpful. Thank you. Yes. So the ugliness of seeing everything up here and then recognizing that some of these words were said to you by your mother, by your priesthood leader, by an ex-boyfriend, by people that you love and trust, and the sadness that comes with that. Did I get that right? Thank you. Next to you. Really angry at the messages. Remembering the shame of sitting in an office with an older white man confessing my sexual sins, as I'm guessing a young woman. Okay. In the back.
Sexual desire is shameful, therefore emotions are bad.
Sexual desire is shameful, therefore emotions are bad. And I think right here, yes. So listening to it all together, it helped you understand that it was about control versus about concern for the individual. Okay, I'm back behind you then. Yes. Yes, you. So the shockingness of how familiar all those phrases were, and at the same time how negative they were. Am I hearing you right, Sarah? So the feeling of I have the power to reject that. Thank you. In the very, very back, in the blue. Anger that it's all about women. Right. We are a little dangerous.
All of these things, you know, male, I always found these to be very frustrating to me because it was like I had no control over things myself. Everything was someone else's fault.
Yes. So as a male, getting the message that you did not have control over your own thoughts or behaviors because it was a woman's fault and how frustrating that was. Okay, two more comments. So the contradiction of the mind F word of... being born with certain natural drives and feelings, and then on the other hand, being told that you're flawed and broken because of those things. Okay, I think in the white in the back there, yes. So the dichotomy of both the kind of virgin shaming that we see, but also the slut shaming that we see, and that both are expectations of other people projected onto us. Did I hear that right? Okay. One more. So the feeling of loss that you spent so much time in your youth trying to remain virginal and then within a day moving into the realm of your life where you were supposed to let go but not knowing how, and then the loss of having to undo so much of that. Okay. Okay, so let's just all take a collective deep breath. Okay, and to honor whatever showed up for you, right? To honor whatever it is that showed up for you, because that informs you. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm really glad that I didn't have to speak for a little bit, because I spent a lot of time with this video, and I can't watch it without tearing up a little bit. It's pretty profound, those messages. But then, like Natasha said, seeing your faces, that was really powerful for me, and thank you for sharing that with me. We went to the two of us went to a conference like last month where another colleague of ours presented on religious sexual shame. And what was interesting is she had mentored a new scholar who actually did her dissertation and was able to come up with this really lengthy, but for the first time, thorough definition of sexual shame. And I will just read that for you. Sexual shame is a visceral feeling of humiliation and disgust toward one's own body and identity as a sexual being, and a belief of being abnormal, inferior, and unworthy. This feeling can be internalized, but also manifests in interpersonal relationships, having a negative impact on trust, communication, and physical and emotional intimacy. Sexual shame develops across the lifespan and in interactions with interpersonal relationships, one's culture and society, and subsequent critical self-appraisal. It's a continuous feedback loop. There's also a fear and uncertainty related to one's power or right to make decisions, including safety decisions, related to sexual encounters, along with an internalized judgment toward one's own sexual desire. Does anyone relate with some of what you just heard, or all, or know people who do? A little bit.
And this is not a Mormon author. I think sometimes we think, oh, this is my Mormonism, right, that ruined me sexually. We have a whole nother presentation on sexual positivity within Mormonism. That's not what this is about today. But this, we really do need to recognize that we come from a puritanical, you know, background in this country in particular. And even before that, there's lots of different backgrounds that we can trace back as far as sexuality and control from religion, politics, economics. You know, there's just, it's very complex, but that we have millennia of this in our, you know, emotional DNA as far as why these things happen. And we're often shocked as we go to these sex therapy conferences and talk with other therapists who come from different religious backgrounds at how much we share in common. Yes, we have our own little quirks in Mormonism, you know, in our own messaging, but this is not by any means individual phenomenon.
Okay. All right. So where can this sexual shame show up in our lives? This is just a smattering of situations that I encounter often with my clients in therapy. If you look at this list, does anyone see any that are not listed here in areas that you now hearing kind of a framing of what sexual shame can feel like and look like and where else it might show up? Any ideas? If not, I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. Feel bad for not feeling bad.
That's a nice problem to have. Yes. No, we're not going to minimize that.
Totally.
Right.
Shouldn't I feel worse?
Shouldn't I feel worse than I do?
Maybe I don't have a strong testimony, right? Because that can translate, like maybe I'm not able to feel the spirit.
Right? I'm not a good enough Mormon. I can't feel the spirit. I'm not worthy. It still goes into all of those types of cognitive distortions, right, that we tell ourselves. Yes. Yeah. Anybody else? So the over-focus on sexuality for you as a youth led to the over-focus of that being an important aspect in your life that was kind of a limiting lens for you. And instead of focusing on a variety of things, it really limited what you were able to enjoy as a teen and even your perception of women, which is something we talk about often is objectification. You often think of what, right? Like cleavage, selling beer, right? That's a typical... But it's just as objectifying to make it all about covering up. And so we really are dealing with two ends of the same spectrum. Yes. Thank you. Yes. Okay, so your experience of going through the 12-step program and therefore identifying, I'm guessing, as an addict or something along those lines, that you weren't just a person who made mistakes, but that you were fundamentally bad. Mm. Thank you. The very back. Okay, so the sexual shame puts women in a secondary position. In other words, if a boyfriend and girlfriend have consensual sex, premarital sex, the woman is held twicely responsible for the sin and for seducing the guy through her porn shoulders or something like that, right?
Well, if she's the guardian of virtue,
right?
Then,
right,
explicitly stated, right, in a young women's conference.
One message that I thought wasn't on here that we didn't talk about is, what the hell about my desire? What about all of you men who are arousing me?
The heck?
Right? Whoop, whoop.
You're welcome.
Right? I mean, there's no acknowledgement that females might actually be horny or have an improper thought or, you know, be turned on by your tight, you know, sacrament pants. And, you know... That's a problem. In the very back. There are no talks about masturbation for females. Right, so the acknowledgement, so women are pure and perfect and fragile and definitely not sexual. Right. Because that's in the bishop's handbook as to questions that you should ask. Yes, thank you.
Questioning.
Which is the question of bishops saying, asking specifically about masturbation to our youth, and then in some cases even asking about orgasm. And that reminds me of a case where, I've had several cases where they're asked about the color of their underwear, because in a sense... That, you know, if you're wearing white granny panties, well, it must have been, you know, a moment of passion that you didn't foresee. If you're wearing red lacy underwear, well, you're kind of preparing for something to come. Okay, everybody, we'll take a deep breath. Yes, we have real issues, right? This is why we're presenting on this. Do you want to?
And I want to add just one thing. That the topic of ecclesiastical interviews and a few that we've already stated really highlights one of the biggest concerns for me, which is a concern for, it can boil down, it's got safety concerns big time, but to be able to advocate for oneself, to be able to defer to your own authority along with perhaps an ecclesiastical leader, if that's appropriate, to be able to say, I don't feel comfortable talking about this, to not even have that as an option, and then later, maybe perhaps with a spouse or a partner, the immense amount of shame that I've heard story after story after story after story with my clients, where they couldn't advocate for what they would maybe perhaps enjoy with the person that they were with, because that would be acknowledging that they had desire, right? And they're probably sweeping stereotypically, but if they're a woman, they are very likely taking on and trying to manage his feelings. So it's about performing for him, or... you know, him having a good time. And so just the barriers that they feel, even just saying what might be more pleasurable and their own desire hits those as well.
Yeah, and for the men, it's oftentimes similar threads, right? So in other words, especially if we're going to talk about stereotypically maybe a man being the higher libido partner, well, then there's something perverse or animalistic or, you know, not natural mannish of me, that I'm imposing myself on this sweet, darling, fragile female wife that I have, right? So that's another rhetoric that we see. Instead of just really being able to talk about how it's normal to have libido discrepancies and that you both have a right to your libido and that you both, that doesn't mean either one of you are broken, right? Or anything along those lines. And so, yeah, we really, short by starting our kids so young in this process of other male authority figures imposing their sexual projections and expectations on them, we teach no sexual boundaries. We teach no ability to say, this is not okay with me. And we also teach that there are big consequences. In other words, you can't go with your friends to the temple trip, or you can't take the sacrament, which is a public display of punishment. And so either, you know, so we learn to either hide our sexuality, or that sexuality comes with a lot of consequence, or we leave, or, you know, I mean, there's like lots of different really negative things that come from this that we could probably talk about for a whole day. I heard my mom laugh. She grew up Catholic. So, I got scared.
We didn't want to talk about something this potentially heavy for a lot of people without at least offering a little something-something to take, or what the heck to do with it, or maybe a way to talk about it with your kiddos or with other people should it come over up over dinner, Sunday dinner. I don't know. Anyway.
In the
at
car.
Least have something to do. And our colleague, the same I was talking about before, her name is Tina Sellers. She came up with these four kind of just little ways to maybe remember how to chew this up, but how to digest it a little bit. Frame, claim, name, and aim.
We can kind of just split these up, but framing is, in essence, building a framework of sexual knowledge. And this takes intentionality, because quite frankly, Mormons have educated us very badly in sexuality. So have our public schools, so has our society, so has our media. I mean, we just do not have a grasp on healthy, comprehensive sexual education in this country and in very few countries. So it takes intentionality. It takes figuring out what are good resources, and we'll have some to share with you at the end, to not only educate yourself in your own sexuality and with your partner if you're partnered, and also with your children. I think the framing of self-compassion is huge. So in other words, this monologue, right, if I'm broken or there's something wrong with me, I call it either, you know, self-shame or partner shame, right? It's either me or you that's having the problem. And maybe it's neither one of those. Maybe we were just taught a bunch of crap, and maybe now we're having to deal with that as a partnership. And maybe we can have some compassion for our younger selves, for the virgin that got married when she was 19, right? For the return missionary who struggled with masturbation on his mission, right? Or we can have compassion for our younger versions of ourselves, and also for our children and for our society and for even for our church leaders who also were sold a bunch of crap on sexuality, right? This is not, I'm not a believer that they're out to get us and that they want to ruin our sexual lives. I just think they don't know any better, and for whatever reason, they're rigidly not open to learning about it. But that's, you know, that comes with a whole nother presentation. So self-compassion, good boundaries, and support systems. So learning about boundaries, learning to say I have a right to my body, learning to say, you know what, my sexuality actually doesn't belong to you, dear wife or dear husband. My sexuality belongs to frickin' me. And I'm going to decide how I want to share my sexuality with you. And if you have a problem with that, well, then let's go talk to somebody who has, you know, skills to help us negotiate our differences and our erotic tastes and all those things that we are going to be different on. Do you want to take claim?
I think I'll take name. I think that's the next
name.
One.
Sorry.
One of my most favorite things to do with clients is to be present as they are learning to name their story, to name what happened, to find, you know, if they're already kind of identifying this was not healthy at all, well, what the heck did happen then? Like, or what has happened over my life and whatnot, and to find a way to tell their story in a way that resonates deeply with them in ways that can be really, really empowering and sad, and just to help move through some of the grief that they likely are feeling toward where it's heading with where they're going to aim. But to name and share their story, including the anxiety and triggers, to own that some of it might not be comfortable at all, and that it's okay, and swinging back to that self-compassion and allowing oneself to go through that process. I love the quote, shame cannot live in the presence of love and begins to fade in the absence of judgment. It is so powerful to witness people see what it feels like to have someone not judge at all what they just said. Like, it's the blink a few times. That is just one of the most beautiful things to watch, and very, very healing for most people.
We get to watch a lot of porn to get us to the point where we're not going to blink at you. So they train us well.
She's talking about a training we have to go through. It's exposure, so that we don't like harm someone.
They expose us to a lot of stuff so that we're not like, what did you do? Or what do you think? Or what? Which is really important. It's important to be able to do that. All right, claiming. So, you know, obviously a big thing that I talk with most of my Mormon clients about is this idea of reclaiming our own authority. So we come from an authority type of culture and religion. So how do we take back our own authority? And a lot of that is giving yourself permission to think differently, to act differently, to believe differently, to claim your own value system, which is what do I really believe instead of what am I told to believe and what is important to me, and also increasing fun and pleasurable experiences that can fall within your value system. So it kind of really opens up this ability to make a lot more decisions and have a lot more options.
And finally, aim. Where do you want to go with it? What's the story that you want to tell one day? I'm an advocate for having it, as cliche as it is, to be a journey. It's a journey of cultivating this part of yourself that is very much so a part of yourself. It's not a luxury. It is a part of you. And to have it be part of your story. And where do you want that to end? And where do you want it to go? Not end. Where do you want it to go?
Everyone, a second what she just said. Sexuality is not a luxury. Let's just sit on that for a minute. It's not a luxury. It's part of your human experience. Oftentimes, religions and even medical communities and all kinds of legal communities will treat it as a luxury, that it's not important enough to prioritize. Your orientation, your gender identity, your sexuality, your desire, your fantasy is part of your integral self, and really owning that.
If you can't tell, we're fans of self-compassion. I heard Emily Nagoski, who is amazing. If you haven't read the book, Come As You Are, it's excellent. Please go get it today. She talks a lot about self-compassion and the three components that can come with that, of self-kindness, common humanity, which I explain to clients, we're all in this together. We're all human. Like, nobody is better than another person. Like, we're all just trying to get through this together, you know. And then being mindful and having awareness and a sense of being okay with whatever might be coming up for you. But we got to know something's coming up, so we got to be mindful. And getting really good at not shoving that away if that's been the pattern throughout your life, or shoving it down or stepping aside and moving through instead of around, up, over, down type of thing.
I'd like to give room for about 4 or 5 comments of maybe things that you feel you have found helpful in managing sexual shame that maybe you feel you've either surpassed or in the process of surpassing. Yes. Can everybody hear that, or is it helpful for me to repeat? Okay, so Marty said that the fear and the shame that you heard from the messages of that we had earlier in the video, that you came to a point where you just decided not to believe that, and unpacking that and what it meant for you in your life was a very helpful process for you. Yes. Great. So being able to talk to other women about sexuality and not being afraid of having those conversations. I'm guessing that was very normalizing. There's probably some humor involved, some tears. That's a very helpful process. Yes. Right here. Okay, so it sounds like you've used some of your critical thinking skills to analyze and evaluate claims that are made by authority figures and deciding for yourself whether or not there's validity to that. Thank you. Very back, and then I'll come to these two. That's you who's turning around. Yes. Okay, so tapping into some initial courage, so it's scary to be able to talk more openly with your wife, with your children, and that as you do that, you recognize that you get more used to it and it becomes a little easier to do over time. Thank you. Okay, these two, and then we'll continue. Yes. So she shared that she herself, her husband and herself, went to some sex therapy, then watched a daughter go through a divorce, a difficult divorce due to sexual dysfunction, and that now they've prioritized as a parental couple to offer premarital sexual education for their children. Like a good Mormon mom. Right? One of the funnest experiences I ever had was at a sexual presentation I did, and it was the parents with their four adult children. And I was like, well, this will be fun. Yes, yes. Go ahead. Right, right. I love the Mormon language you used in that. So learning to recognize your right to personal revelation, which we are taught we have, and being able to use that to discern whether or not some of these messages you were receiving felt correct to you. And I do want to just touch on that I think this isn't an all or nothing. It's not like every single message we received in the church was negative about sexuality. There's a lot of positive stuff. And again, if we learn how to use the doctrines that we have in Mormonism, like personal revelation, like choosing the higher principle, all those kinds of things, then we can combat some of this. But that takes some effort because it's not usually what's coming over the pulpit. What is purity? Yes, it's weird. How do we define these words? Okay, I'm going to try to ignore the rest of the comments. I'm like, oh. Okay, just because I know we're almost out of time. What time is it? 4:40. Okay, so we have 5 minutes. So we're going to open it up to questions. And since my brother was one of the ones giving his hand up, I'm going to say, what did you want to say? Because I really felt sister guilt shutting you down.
I think outside of Mormon religion, like young guys talk about that, there's
Right. Okay. Yeah, so being exposed to ways that other cultures and other peoples talk about these things, and that the shame and the fear that we have in our culture oftentimes drives things into secrecy, and that we don't know how to talk about things. Okay, so we're in question mode now, so we'll just open it up for the next 5 minutes. Yes? Yes.
So what I did was I showed how very clearly that scripture has nothing to do with sex.
I'm going to walk around with this so I don't have to keep repeating people's things.
The sin next to murder, as is clearly defined in that scripture, is causing someone else's spiritual death, not sexuality. Sexuality isn't mentioned in there at all. And you can go through and you can cross-reference it back to Alma's own experience earlier, where he was in the pains of hell because he had caused the spiritual death of others. And I had so many people come up to me privately afterwards and were so grateful that I had kind of exploded that myth. And when someone brought up Elder Holland's talk, I said, he's wrong about it. And
no, right. No, and that there are very different, there's misunderstandings, there's misinterpretations when it comes to scriptural story. I mean, the seed of Onan, for example, right? Spilling the seed. Well, a lot of people use that for masturbation. It actually was because he didn't want to share his heritage and get the other woman pregnant, right? So there's all kinds of ways that we can spin these stories or that they've been spun. By the way, feet is really a metaphor for genitalia. So when is it Ruth lies at the feet of her man or whatever, you know, that she's trying to seduce. Yeah, go there. So anyway, yes.
My question kind of ties in with what was mentioned about terms that we use so frequently in this culture that are undefined. And I just wanted to talk a little bit maybe about self-respect because that's something that growing up was always immediately tied in with modesty, with sexuality, with all of that. And not just self-respect, but respect for God. And it's bothersome to me because it wasn't until I really asked myself what self-respect meant that I realized it had nothing to do with, in my experience, in my opinion. So I guess my question is there a right way to respond to somebody who directly ties those two things, links them, you know, what your sexual decisions are is directly linked with your self-respect for yourself?
Well, I don't know what you want to say to that, but what I heard you say, which you've already done beautifully, is for me. Mm-hmm. Because two things can't be trumped: God and people's idea of God, who God is, and your own experience. So when you say, well, for me, that's not exactly how I think about that, they're not going to be able to come back at you much. They might try. It's when we say, this is the way it is, you know. So do you understand what I'm saying? It's the trick of being able to say, well, okay, I can see how maybe you feel that way about self-respect, or maybe that's how you define self-respect. I guess I don't define it that way. For me, it means this. Now you're having a dialogue, right? And it may not go well, but at least it's a way to be able to say your piece without doing a lot of things that I've done, which are not super helpful, like walk out in a fury.
I think also the concept of the higher principle or higher values, I think that's an option there where self-respect isn't only connected to wardrobe or whatnot, or who someone's dating or whatnot, and their sexuality. It's also maybe someone has the principle of respecting that they have a sexual self. And I mean, anyway, you can kind of pick creativity.
I like my cleavage too. Okay, mine is more of a comment than a question, but I put my kids through the Unitarian Universalist sex education our whole lives. It's for different ages. It's directed specifically to different age groups in their development, and they are very, very sex positive, but also talk about the risks of sexuality or the risks of making certain sexual decisions. My kids came out knowing more about sex than me, I thought, and that was good, and that was healthy for them. And so I think that's something that you can look into, Our Whole Lives OWL program.
It's a sex education program.
Physical and emotional risk. Yes, my husband is reminding me that they talk about the physical and emotional risks of any sexual decision, but in a non-shaming way, and that meant the world to me to have that.
The Unitarian Church, and it's OWL, O-W-L, and they actually talk about pleasure, imagine. So right now, the United States, for most states, you're not really allowed to talk about anything other than reproduction. So the clitoris is not a reproductive organ, and many, many women graduate from high school and even college not knowing that they have a clitoris or what its purpose is. What time is it? Okay, so we're done. We need to leave. But we're welcome to, you know, again, approach us, please. We're at the tables downstairs. And
thank you.
Thank you so much. I particularly want to thank everybody's comments. This is what made this so rich, I think, was everybody willing to share very personal things. Thank you.